Hello, and welcome to Muse and Metrics. This is your host, Philippa Burgess. This is Season 5, Episode 10, and today's topic is Ladders and Leaps.
I'm Paulina Ravinsky. I am a WTM Ambassador, Women Tech Makers. I'm a recent ambassador, just joined about 2 months ago. Right now, I'm Executive Director and Founder of To The She Power, which is a company I started to help fellow women get into tech and thrive once they're there. So I spend a lot of time mentoring, coaching, and trying to create content that is meant to educate and inspire and connect. Before that, I spent many years in software engineering, and I even stumbled into that sort of accidentally because I started out as a full stack developer more than 20 years ago with ABC News. Then later, I became a Java developer, and probably more than 10 years, I was a Java developer with Disney and a variety of different teams of products. Then I stepped into leadership roles, so that was a big shift. I became a team lead, then later manager, senior manager, and so on. And when I left my corporate career, I was director of software engineering, which kind of blows my mind because I don't have a computer science degree, but that was just something that led me to my real passion, which was women in tech groups. I ran those for some time, both at Disney and Rosetta Stone, and decided during the pandemic I needed to try something new. And so here I am. I have a board of advisors, and we've just been working on a variety of ways of really making some impact out there among other women.
Where did you sort of see or get connected with women tech makers?
I saw this one. I think one of my connections, his wife and business partner, is pretty tightly involved with the program. When I saw something about it on LinkedIn and it said, oh, apply. And, you know, I just sounded so interesting. But to be honest, and I think I was like the only person who didn't realize that it's affiliated with Google until after I was, because when I started telling people I had been selected to be an ambassador, people had much bigger reactions than I did. I just thought, oh, this seems like something that's really aligned with my values and what I'm doing. And, you know, I'm excited about this topic, so why not? I'll apply. And then when I started looking at it further, I got so excited. So I'm really glad that whatever it was, I have a thing that I really, you know, with age, I have started to really follow anything that resonates with me, right? Like when I feel that little like resonance and magnetism for something, and I think like, what's that? Or that's curious, or that person, I'm curious, you know, that I follow whatever it is, because I always find it leads me to something great. And I've just been so excited. But even just the onboarding and the conversations that we've had with the North America group, I'm just so excited. It's for me, being part of community, I love that it's such a supportive community. I mean, it just, even with the few interactions I've had, so it's such a perfect place to try something new that you're just starting to be like, okay, am I ready? Am I not ready? And step out. And I mean, I feel like I'm in the same place with all the things I'm trying, but just even in our onboarding session, there was so much talk about how like, well, I'd never done it before, and I just stepped into it and I learned the hard way, and everyone's like, yes, yes, do that. And so, yeah, I love that. And I think, you know, and this, I also have to say one more thing, because I have such a connection with International Women's Day, because I was born in Russia. And so my first 10 years I lived in Russia, and in Russia, March 8th is a huge holiday. And you give flowers to your teacher and your mom and like your grandma and, you know, anyone else, your neighbor. So it's really, really focused on, it's there to celebrate women, and it's truly international. And it wasn't until, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago that I feel it started having a place of celebration in the U.S. And I just was so excited because it was like a connection to my youth and this point where it was always that celebration of women.
I love that. Yeah, I've seen that. I mean, obviously, we have global politics going on right now, and I've been paying a lot more attention to what's happening with Russia and Ukraine. I've been learning Russian and Ukrainian. And I'm at a point where I actually my keyboard. I have all of the Cyrillic letters and I've got the stickers on, so I can practice. And but I see a lot of the holidays that they celebrate, which actually I think is actually quite special.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll have to practice some Russian.
Please. No, actually that's what they actually say. They say when you're learning a language, the best way to learn a language is connect with native speakers.
That's amazing. I do. Language is, another passion of mine. So,
I'm loving learning. And I think that once I got past the alphabet, once I learned the alphabet, then I realized how many words are so similar. Once I could read them, passport is passport. I mean, there's just hundreds and hundreds of words that are the same. And I know
vodka is vodka,
Vodka is vodka. Isn't like plage beach, because that's French.
Uh-huh. Plage. Uh-huh.
And so there's a lot of, and I'm also looking at Dutch, and I'm actually really fascinated by Dutch because I know some French, I know some German, and it is basic, and I speak English. Dutch is basically a mashup of English, French, and German.
I love that you're learning multiple languages at once. That's like a multi-threaded, that makes me think of, multi-threading and software engineering. Because as a human brain, we have a hard time really multitasking, but...
I'll do it in simple ways. For example, like with Bard, the other day I was with Bard. I was like, what are the colors in French? And then what are the colors in Spanish? What are the colors in Dutch? What are the colors in Russian? What are the colors in German? And you realize how, once you actually start looking at multiple languages, like rose, pink is basically rose in most languages.
Wow. So it's like horizontal language learning, because it's not intuitive. I always feel like, we think of it as a vertical concept, that you dig deeper into a single language, but kind of learning it. Wow. I'm really fascinated by that. I'm going to have to think about that some more.
Well, there's a fabulous book called The Loom of Language, which another language teacher had said, this is one of the best books. Uh-huh. And part of what they say is, be comfortable being uncomfortable, be comfortable making mistakes. There is no perfection in this.
What you said about be comfortable with being uncomfortable, that's such a topic with everything. I feel that that's something that, there's no perfection, make mistakes, learn from mistakes. I feel like this is a topic I think about in my business. It's what I talk about in all my various, I'm a volunteer as a mentor at an academy where they're training women to get into tech. But I do lots and lots of mentorship sessions. That's something I talk about all the time, is that, progress over perfection, don't get all caught up in it, be comfortable being uncomfortable. It's what I tell my son. My son just started high school that has they focus on design thinking. So it's all about, ideate, make mistakes, learn by doing. And I don't know. This is just as soon as you said that, it's just so close to me on so many levels and so many different things that I'm involved in right now. So yeah, that's just sparked that in me.
Yeah, no, and that's this part of the learning journey. Mm-hmm. I think also, this is a whole other thought process, but one thing that I never really encountered or understood was educational trauma. Because I've had such a positive environment, both in school and at home. I was an eager learner. I was a quick learner. I was a relatively good student unless I got lazy. I got really in trouble when I transitioned from a very cushy elementary school environment where I still learned a lot and had a very solid foundation into high school, where it was a lot more independent study. Mm-hmm. And it took me a while to sort of go, oh, I gotta up my game here. I went on to university. I've always loved learning, and I had a really good experience with it. And then I started meeting people who had anxiety and trauma around learning, and then made it about themselves. I'm not smart enough. I'm not good enough. And it's to explain no, you just really weren't taught that well. Your teachers or family or other people around you kind of failed you in that. And that was not you, but you've internalized it. You've made it about yourself. And now there's a panic and a fear around learning. Uh-huh. Or some people have testing anxiety. And so I think that that's another thing they say, in order to be able to learn, you have to be calm and joyful. Mm-hmm. And I did a teaching course. USC kind of offered a certificate for future faculty, and it was a free certificate. And USC does not always offer things for free. So I signed up for that. I said, okay, let's kind of learn about teaching. And there was a graph where it was, there was part of it was the boredom graph and part of it was anxiety. And the teacher, the path was keeping students, like not tipping them over into too much anxiety, but mm-hmm. not also tipping them into too much boredom. Like you've got to find that happy medium between being appropriate. And so a lot of times I'll use the word appropriately challenged.
Right. But when it's so individual, right? Like what works for one kid is completely different that works for another kid. I mean, I think, you know, being in technology and being in the private sector and being in these, you know, media company where the focus was on things that really, if you like steps way back, are fluffy, right? Like what I would love to see is all these companies that are focused on the perfect ad serving solution or, you know, the perfect streaming, you know, I love streaming, don't get me wrong, but I would love to see them focus on education, is it? Cause I think it's just woefully outdated. What's being taught in schools is completely not relevant to the kind of skills they need these days. And kids are just bored out of their minds. I mean, like I said, I have a teenager, he just turned 15, and being around these kids, they are not no longer suited to take in information the way that it's being presented to us, the way it was presented to us and the way it's still being presented to them. And what they really need to be taught is systems thinking, you know, and things which are much more complex than making them remember a bunch of dates or, you know, so there isn't, it's not moving, education is not changing fast enough to really suit what the modern world needs. And for me, it's obviously very relevant with the child. And so, you know, I'm grateful we were able to find this public school. It's a public school that offers this incredible program. But that's what I would love to see is all these powerful, huge companies really focus on revamping education. It's just really sorely needed.
I completely agree with that. And also, I mean, I just take it from my own. So though I didn't have any educational trauma or educational like anxiety, I to me, like learning is fun. Learning is easy. Mm-hmm. I'm on a second master's degree and it's a joyful place for me. But I also feel that a lot of people just don't connect the dots. And that was the one failing that I did see. Is that if you gave me an instruction, I would take it. So when I was in a trigonometry class, okay, we're doing it. Nobody framed it with a real world application.
Yes.
And when I had one of my first summer internships was with a video production company, a video editing company. And it was digital technology. And we're talking about like in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And I was asking about, well, how does this technology work? Those were the kind of questions that I was curious about. And the owner of the company, who was basically saying, well, it'd be really hard to explain to you because you'd have to understand trigonometry. And I'm like, I just finished that semester. I'm all in. Tell me more. But I was like, why couldn't they have framed it at the beginning of the semester, how applicable it was? Yeah. And also as a woman, and I don't know if it's as a woman, because my dad's an accountant and an engineer. So I got at home, I got a really solid math foundation. Like it was, I remember him like drilling me on my times tables, like, and joyfully, like it was just something that it was really important that I knew and understood math and that, and I really was told all of its real world applications, uh-huh. But in school, in an academic environment, I was never really encouraged in the maths or the sciences. And now I'm going back because I'm in a master of science and I'm learning spatial data science. And basically a lot of them and machine learning and AI are saying, you really need to know statistics. You uh-huh. really need to know calculus. And fortunately there are things like Khan Academy. Fortunately, right. There's so many free low cost resources. So in addition to my academic program, I do a lot of self-study, whether it's learning how to do video editing, because now I'm doing a lot more with content, or learning foreign languages, or learning, you know, just getting better at programming, AI, machine learning, or now, you know, folding in statistics and calculus into that, because I'm understanding that the leaders in my field are saying this is important and why it's important. Mm-hmm. And so if you give me that context, I'm going to do even better.
That's amazing. You know, we just met, but I love just how much like your joy of learning. I mean, it's come up in every which way. I really love it. Like, and I can see it on your face that you've got that true excitement, and the joy of learning is, it just kind of emanates from you. So I love that.
And what I'm trying to do now is in my small ways, just inspire that in others and make it so that it's not so scary. And I think one of the joys I also have in being a graduate student is I absolutely trust the process. I know that the professors in the department have planned a learning transformation for me. And no matter how out of my depth I am, for example, I just did a lightning talk for women in GIS, and the topic was education. And so I just said, you know, I'm going to just share my journey of how I got into GIS from urban planning into the human security degree and sort of the process in between. And I had a question came up in the chat. She said, this is a serious question. I'm not joking. Like, this is totally serious. Did you cry when you were learning the software? And my answer was yes. Yes, there were a lot of tears and lots of gray hair, which I have since covered with. But yes, it absolutely brought me to tears. And I think that that's what happens is that that's where that educational trauma kicks in. Yeah. Is if you have trauma, now you're going to make it about, this is my stopping point. This is where, mm-hmm. you know, all that past nonsense is going to, which is real, just hasn't been worked through, mm-hmm. is going to come up and now get in your way. Yeah. Whereas if you don't have trauma, you're just like, this is really frustrating, but I'll get through it.
Yeah.
I'll figure it out. I'll find the lifeline. I'll call a classmate. I'll set up office hours with my professor. I'll look for the tutorial, or I'll just poke around with this through my tears until I figure this out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I see, it's interesting you brought up the term. I didn't know this was a term, I guess. What did you say? Educational trauma?
Is that? Yeah.
Yeah. Because I mean, I can see it, you know, I'm a perfectionist, so I'm sure I contributed to my son becoming a perfectionist. I fight it all the time. You know, I'm conscious of it and I try. But watching it in this kid, you know, like go to school and put so much pressure on themselves, and just is, there has not been any joy in him in years. And it's really hard to watch. It really like hurts me to see that. And, you know, during the pandemic, I think we talked a little bit about how the pandemic was such a game changer for everyone. But also so many of us decided to take different paths. And during that time, I mean, there was a day where he called me and he was just crying so hard. And I couldn't even understand what he was saying, but he was in this, you know, he was in advanced classes, but not enjoying it. And so, yeah, he was in this algebra test and he like left the test because he was so upset that he couldn't figure out something, that he was in the bathroom crying and he was like, come and get me. I can't be here anymore. And that was really the moment where I said, what the hell, like, what am I doing, you know, to him? Like, this isn't how it's supposed to be. If it feels like that, if he is just so disconnected and dispirited and stressed out and, you know, feels so much anxiety about it, like, why are we doing this? Like, what's the point? So, yeah. So that's when, you know, we started more of an alternative, which thankfully I live in Seattle. So in Seattle, we have a lot of the public school district. I mean, it's not great, but it has a lot of options, right? It's a big district. So there was some alternative programs that he could get into. And so that's been the journey now for like going on third year, just trying to reawaken some engagement and excitement about learning. And this is why I commented on yours, because it's such a joy to see that in others. Like anyone who is, you know, my mentees, anyone who is like, I'm enjoying learning this so much. Like, it's such a joy to see that in people, and not to see that in my own son's been really hard. And yeah, I'm just hoping, like, I think this year things are finally shifting. And so I'm grateful for the changes because, yeah, being from Russia, since you're somewhat been following the cultural I mean, we were the value of education, and education was just drilled into us. Since you were a kid, it's like education, 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 get in there, learn. And so, you know, so I followed that. And then as many parents do, you kind of start doing the same thing to your kids, you know, where you're like, you have to learn, and, you know, you have to get into a good college. Like I said, all the same things they told me, you have to get into a good college. And then one day when he was 10, he said, I said, all right. And this is like amazing how insightful these like kids are sometimes. He said, okay, let me get this straight. So I have to work hard in school so I can get into a good college, so I can work hard there, so I can get a good job. And then I can work hard there and be stressed out all the time. And then I die. Like he literally, I was like, ooh, like he's not wrong. I mean, that is our society, right? It is kind, hopefully you have some joy along the way, but that is what our society teaches. And it's been an amazing shift for me. I feel so, you know, happy that COVID helped establish this shift in me. My story of the pandemic is just so, it's so unexpected, because if you, well, for so many of us, right? So, but when you go back, if you go back to December 2019, I had just accepted the position at Rosetta Stone. They were like recruiting me. I was doing great at Disney, but they were recruiting me. And they said, we'll make you director. And then, you know, my boss said, oh, I'll groom you for my role. So I was, you know, I was climbing the ladder. I was fully committed to that. I was like, yep, okay, director. And then I'm going to take his VP spot when he moves on. And I had zero. If you had told me then that less than 2 years later, I was going to walk away from my career, no one would have predicted that. I mean, my family is still shocked that I did this. But, you know, I moved into this new role. 3 weeks after I started, we went full remote. So I never even met most of my team. I had a team that was distributed across the country. We even had plane tickets to go meet a bunch of them out in Virginia, never got on the plane, and never, you know, I never met them. And just trying to do that work completely remotely in that I had no relationships, right? So I was starting from zero, building relationships with all these people. And it was very draining. It was like incredibly draining, because I had my own stressors at home and my own anxieties about pandemic, like everyone else, my son and virtual school. And, you know, we were doing it. I was getting through it. It was hard. But then my boss, who was the one who recruited me, got pushed out. And the guy who stepped in had been with the company for some time, but he was in an IT function. He'd never worked with product engineering, which, you know, my whole career was product engineering. And he was just honestly the ultimate bro, like that ultimate guy who's like, just scare him into doing what you want. And like, he would just tell me just like, why isn't your team? And he wasn't willing to listen to what the real needs were. He wasn't understanding that that isn't how you inspire engineers, right? Like engineers don't do better work if you scare them. That's just, I don't know. Maybe he hasn't learned that. Maybe he has. But ultimately, after about 4 months reporting to him, then I started to get the kind of, I told you, I've been very focused on women in tech. So I know about the types of fake feedback women tend to get. I know what a conscious bias looks like. I've done the training for other people. I've held trainings that were big, large group trainings. And just seeing that this was now my boss, and he was saying things like, well, I just don't think you look like a leader. And, you know, just these kind of, it was so incredibly frustrating. So I hit this point where I thought, what am I doing this for? So much of my energy, I have nothing left to give after this job. I'm on 10 hours of calls a day. I have this guy who has these expectations of how I'm supposed to act like him. Nothing really productive is happening here. Like, I'm a problem solver, and they didn't want to solve the problems that they had. And I just was done. I was done. And I collect my bonus. And then the very next day I gave notice and I had no plan. I just knew I wanted to really focus on something that was more aligned with my values. And also I felt was giving something good to the universe. It was, for me to place my energy into something that I felt was doing good, not something that was pointless or placating somebody I didn't even respect. And so I just leapt and, there was more. I applied for a couple of jobs thinking like, maybe I'll do a full-time DEI role. And the more information I gathered on that, the less attractive that seemed and a couple of other things. And then ultimately I just said, okay, I have to think bigger now, right? Like this is, the universe is telling me I have to think bigger. And I've never, ever thought of myself as an entrepreneur. And then I just stepped into that role. So yeah, that's
exciting and scary at the same time, because there's a lot of, there's a lot that goes into it. You just wear so many hats when you're an entrepreneur. There's just so much that you have to do. I remember my first time coming out of corporate, going into an entrepreneurial life. And I defined it as swimming through tar, because in corporate, you could just put something in your outbox and somebody would stamp it and they would mail it. And they all had all the supplies there. So they would have given you the envelope and the paper and the computer and the printer. And like, and then when you were an entrepreneur, you're like, oh, I got to go buy ink. Oh, wait, I got to go to the post office. Like, I just remembered like how we were doing a lot of in the script world. So I had to go get photocopies at my own cost. I had to like just buy my supplies. I had to just everything that had been so easy in corporate, they just took care of so many things and they had so many people doing those things. Now it was you doing all of those things.
Right.
And that was a big transition just mentally, just like to understand that the pace and the ease that corporate life kind of gives you and that security that it gives you, you have to kind of rethink that. Yeah.
Surprise. Yeah. I know. Yeah, no, and you're right. And it's all you. And then, you know, I think for me, I do get the one thing I miss. There's only one thing I miss about, well, my paycheck. But I also miss that sense of being part of a team and working towards a common goal. And it is hard to get that kind of inspiration from when you're on your own, right? You have to really seek the inspiration. There isn't that sense of we're in it together and let's solve this problem together, which I really did inspire me. And I loved the people I worked with. And so that's one thing that's missing when you're solo. So right now, more and more, I'm looking for collaboration opportunities, having that back and forth, and then how much richer ideas become when you're working with someone else and it's not just all in your head. And I'm seeking more and more ways to have more of those types of interactions and get that kind of inspiration.
I agree with that, and I understand that in sort of a different way. There's the internal team that you work with, but there's also being part of an industry. Mm-hmm. And that you work in a larger community, you go to conferences, you meet, there's like cross-industry communication. I'm starting to identify as like part of GIS. And now I'm sort of even networking and building a community within the IC community. And this little sense of belonging is now showing up again. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it takes time, not only to build it internally, but also to build it externally.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting because even in our onboarding call, so many of the ambassadors spoke about how that really, they also found themselves community-less and how much that meant to them. And I mean, for me, that just resonates so much. Being part of something, I mean, we all read, like that's a basic human need and desire, right? Being part of a tribe, being part of a quest, being part of a mission is what we all seek. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah, about I think about 5 months into me just saying like, well, I'm just starting a business, like I don't have a plan or anything, but I was like, I'll figure out branding, I'll get my website going, I'll do this, I'll do that. And then I hit that point where I said, I really want to bounce ideas off of others, want to get input. And I felt that, well, it seems everyone's so busy with their own lives. And so I have some very valued connections and colleagues and friends that I felt, oh, well, I would be imposing on them if I was saying, hey, let's meet and like bounce ideas. Or so this is, I mean, it's not revolutionary, but I decided I was going to start a board of advisors. And I thought, okay, what's the most sort of like diverse group I can create on some different levels. And I just reached out to some of my contacts and I said, I knew they were passionate about women in the workplace and women's empowerment as well. And so asking them, oh, so will you be on my board of advisors? And it was such a vulnerable moment because I thought that they would be able to see that I just needed input from other people and that it was about me. But then surprisingly, after the first one, I felt so much better because this is an amazing woman. And she just said, I'm so honored that you asked me. And she was truly really touched. And she said, I believe in the same values and we share these values and I would be so honored to be on this journey with you. And I thought, wow, okay. They went so much better than what I thought. I thought people would say, I have limited time or you're calling in a favor, right? Like I really felt I was calling in a favor. But then having that reaction emboldened me to ask a couple more people. And so now I build my little team to collaborate with. I have to say that some of the time I still feel like I'm calling in a favor, and they have to remind me that that's not what they're there for. But our conversations are so fruitful, and it's so amazing to have that support in the different viewpoints, right? Because my entire career was in, you know, product engineering, so I have that more of the engineering side mindset. But I have some people who are really focused on the product side, and they remind me of what it takes to productize something and think about market fit and differentiation, all these things, which were not really things I thought about, right? I thought about building. And so I love the viewpoint. I love the just the variety of inputs. It just makes the whole experience so much richer. I really just love these women. They're fantastic. Like that, because I'm also in a space where I'm not really making money, but just to kind of, I think so many women have that relationship with money where it's just a little bit like you're a little uncomfortable asking for it, you're a little uncomfortable reaching for it, saying you want it, saying you should keep it, like what you said, you know, this is mine, I've earned this. It's an evolving relationship that I think a lot of women have with money. And yeah, and even, you know, for me, whenever I get bogged down in, okay, focus on monetization, I mean, that's not a place I like being. I like being in the creative space, like you said, where it's just really value driven and impact. What's the impact that I'm making? And so I'm letting myself stay here a little longer, but yes, monetization does need to happen eventually. And to say that, like what you said, I deserve this, I earned this, I was the one who took this risk and got us to where we are.
Yeah. And another thing that, if just from a financial point of view, and this is my dad as the accountant, was mm-hmm. saying that you should also always have 3 accounting sheets. And what I like about accounting mm-hmm. sheets is that just open up a sheet and just like vision what's possible with your numbers. No mm-hmm. attachment to it. You don't actually have to realize, but just sort of say, if I did this, what's possible? Mm-hmm. You know, if I sold this many units at this price to this many people, what's possible? And then, you know, understanding what are some of like your fixed costs that you just can't get around. Mm-hmm. And like that gives you some goals and things like guardrails of like, okay, I really need to sort of get myself here. But the three Let's see if I get them right. I know one of them is your profit loss. Okay. What are you making versus what are you spending? Profit loss. The other one is your net worth, like your whole thing, like your you know, so the big picture net worth kind of things. And the other, oh, the first one is cash flow. Because you can put some things on credit and that's cash flow. You need to just kind of like keep the lights on cash flow. But then you need to make sure like profit loss, like expenses, income. And then you need to see like the whole picture. Like for me, like I said, right now, like with my student loans, I'm just not really looking at that. But it's there. And at some point I need to have a plan to be like, and how do I address that? Right now I'm focused more on cash flow. Cash flow is really where I'm at. I haven't even gotten into a profit loss statement yet, but that's kind of where I want to get to next.
I think your dad would be proud of you. Look at that. You're following his advice. I love it.
But it's three ways to talk about money, because I do hear business owners kind of just talk about the cash flow piece of it, mm-hmm. but without mm-hmm. actually saying, and what's my profit mm-hmm. versus those expenses, and how long am I willing to sort of run this out? Because I think you also need to make peace with yourself and your family. Like, how long does this work for, right. you know, versus when do I actually need to go get a job? And probably the biggest lesson for me as a small business owner was I actually quietly became queen of the part-time jobs because that actually gave me a much longer runway. Uh-huh. And I found the things that I could do that didn't conflict with my business. So for example, I was working as a, and this is where it was hard because there was a glamour piece to it and a perception piece to it. So I was Hollywood literary manager. It mm-hmm. sounded fancy and I had the clients and I had the relationships and things were moving and we'd get small paychecks, but because we were on commission, we could not move it any faster or change a very fixed business model. And anything we did outside of that was considered out of integrity. Mm-hmm. And so we, you know, could never charge writers anything but the 10%. And all of like in the beginning when it was actually physical photocopies, like we had to go copy the scripts at our expense. We had to ship them out. Or when we got a better reputation, they'd send messengers services to come pick up those scripts at our office. And I had a little office. I had overhead. And I had, you know, people I worked with. And so I always found, and whether I was a paralegal, a nanny, an apartment manager, a conference coordinator, like I did all sorts of things, but I never wanted to be your barista. Like I never wanted people to see me in a public forum because it sort of broke the narrative, you know, just it's like I had to kind of have these two personalities. But then as we grew as a business, we realized that we could do marketing consulting, stand-up websites, social media marketing, other things to other clients in a more consulting capacity. And so now our company had two departments. We work with screenwriters over here, 10% commission model. We work with experts and authors and small businesses in this other thing where and that's when I started stopping the outside work and just kind of could bring it inside. But I still realized I needed another kind of department to supplement sort of what really was sort of our passion work.
And well, so I feel like services are so in demand that that's such a natural transition. Like you said, digital marketing, social media, content creation, like all of that is so in demand. I wish I had some of those skills, but I actually love my side hustles. My one that I started, which really I love because it pays for my mortgage. I Airbnb the downstairs of my house, and it's just been, it's kind of a funny little side business. And it really, I mean, it, like I said, it pays for my mortgage. So we live for free. That's nice. And then taking project jobs. And I don't know, there's just even the whole concept of side hustles, like makes me feel kind of more flexible, and you get a little bit here, a little bit there. It makes me feel more creative. I really love it. I actually would want to find a third side hustle, but yeah, my second one, I did this big project as a technical project manager recently, and that went really well. So I'm looking to do a little bit more of that. And I don't know, maybe you should give me advice on what other side hustles I can add, because I'm liking this idea.
Well, I think what it does is it gives you more runway as an entrepreneur, because there is, you know, and it gives you less pressure from family, because usually often it's a significant other who is the one saying, what are we doing here? and or, you know, sort of extended family, everybody wants you to be safe. And so it gives you that sense of safety. And a lot of times, like, these just things take longer than we anticipate. I believe it's a Bill Gates quote where he sort of says, we overestimate what's possible in 2 years. We underestimate what's possible in 10 years.
Okay.
And some of this is related to technology and how much technology will change over a period of time. But I also think it's in terms of how much we can actually accomplish.
Oh, I love that. I'm really going to think about that quote because, yeah, I can. Yeah, that's. I think that's very true. And it is inspiring for me to think what I could accomplish in 10 years. And that's, yeah, very exciting to think about.
And so I think that runway is key. So, and I think there's another thing in terms of, you know, how do you, again, find out, like, what is that side hustle? And I think you've identified some of it very well, which is, you know, what is a resource or inventory, an asset inventory? Your asset is a home with additional space. Your asset is your skills and experience, your corporate, your resume. You speak multiple languages, like things that, you know, those are all in your assets. You're personable and friendly. You're part of a community. You're generous with your ideas and input. I think one of the things I'd also sort of seen in is, like, you find a communication line, doesn't matter what it is, find a communication, find out what the needs are, and then, you know, create and produce what is needed and wanted where there's a budget allocated to it, whether that's a personal budget, whether it's a business budget. I have always found selling to businesses easier than selling to people for services, because services, corporate budgets are very different than personal budgets.
Right.
And in services, you need to kind of mark up your time because it's very finite. There's only so much to sell. So I do find that, but if I have maybe a widget that I was selling, a book that I was selling, something that was productized, then selling it at a low price point to a lot of people makes sense. But when it comes to services, I definitely sell services to companies, not people.
Yeah, no. And I like that because even when I've really started to market my coaching, I really, you know, I don't want to charge individuals who are just starting out on a career, who need advice. Like, I love the idea of just sharing of my gifts. I just being generous with that. And at, you know, at the same time, we talk about the need, obviously we need the financial stability, but when you're selling to a corporation, I mean, yeah, like you said, it's very different. It's what an individual would consider big money is pennies on a corporate budget. And also you don't have that sort of like, I don't want to take this from you. I want to share my gifts with you. I want to take that from you. If you're a company, I'm ready to take that from you. And let's, you know, pay up, show me the money.
Yeah. So that's just, you know, kind of those sort of thought processes of really sort of, but a lot of it is the same thing. If like you're looking for a grant, you're looking for a scholarship, you don't tell them what their needs are. It's a listening exercise. And then you shape yourself to say, I'm a really good candidate for what you're looking for. And so I think that it's similar in productizing for a small business. It's a listening exercise as well. Like, where are the gaps in the market? What's needed? Or also starting with, I think there's that phrase, the fresh in the familiar. So familiar is like, who else does this and what's working? What do they sell? Are they doing events? Are they doing conferences? Are they doing an info product? Are they doing one-on-one? Are they building out a team and having, you know, those people deliver it? You know, what's the structure? Is it based on a book? Is it based on media? Like, what is that? And then adding your own take to it. Like, where are you fresh? What's new and different from your point of view? But I think one of the reasons why I fell in love with the idea of YouTube monetization was I have in all of my transitions, and I think being a student and everything, I'm really out of wanting to sell anything to anyone. I just don't want to be in sales. And I have a background in marketing, which is to say, like, what is marketing? Marketing is getting people to care. So I'm interested but to me, like the product, I was trying to like, explain it to my mom, you know, she's like, well, can I make money on you? Like, what is that a job? Like, what are you doing? And I was like, well, it's kind of like you do Airbnb, Uber, and YouTube actually are very similar in their business models, because all of them, you come with an asset, mm-hmm. a vehicle, a house, or in this case, a camera and some editing and your final deliverable is a video. And they bring the audience. Mm-hmm. You turn on the app, you set it up. And as long as the audience likes what you're doing, you get good reviews, you get served up in the algorithm. And so if you do a good job, like they'll continue to deliver you the customers.
Uh-huh.
And YouTube's not different. And so to me, you really do need like millions of views to actually kind of get to a monetize, like I could make a living from this, uh-huh. but you get their consistency, quality. Like there's just, to me, it's like, I'm in this big like learning curve. But the idea is like, if people show up at my restaurant and eat in my like little YouTube land, they're charged by the ads or they're charged by their subscription. Like I never have to say, buy something from me. I do have to say, please subscribe, please like, please come back, please engage, you know, and eventually later, if my audience kind of were to demand a product of me, well, it's like, hey, so many people asked, I put it in a book. Hey, so many people asked, I put it in a course. Hey, people asked and I need to charge to go speak at that conference.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I'll get there, but I'd rather be hired for my services in spatial data analyst, like project manager, and like mm-hmm. other kind of contract positions where I can actually like apply all these technical, educational, academic things that I'm learning. But from a content point of view, I'd love to monetize, but based on that mm-hmm. idea of I'm just delivering enough value that yeah. I let the technology and they've figured out all the monetization strategies. They're the ones who have whole sales teams working with those advertisers.
Yeah. Well, and it can be such a goldmine. So how far away are you from starting your channel? I want to hear about this.
So, you know, baby steps with things. It started with the podcast. It started with just straight audio. And it started in January 22, where I was saying, okay, just like, I met Lori and it was like, okay, I'm doing this. But then it was like playing with YouTube and just actually realizing how much goes into it. And mm-hmm. also realizing I'm like, I'm interested in so many different things and that was kind of confusing. And a lot of people are like niche down. And that's where I got the idea of like, oh, I can have multiple channels that each focus on a particular aspect of my interests. And in that way, like I have little universes of stories and there's a, I read a lot of memes. One of them was, or short videos where, you know, sort of the husband is like, you know, what are you going to go buy at Target? And she's like, I don't know. Target will tell me what I'm going to buy at Target. Like, I'll figure it out when I get there. And I sort of feel like once you build a channel and you sort of start, the channel kind of tells you what's next. The channel kind of reveals like, oh, that's the next video. I have found literally thousands of ideas for videos, but I realized like there's a whole skill set. And the one that I'm missing right now is editing. So when I very, very first started, I'd make a slide presentation and I'd kind of get in front of camera and I'd kind of talk through my slide presentation and like make a little cover that kind of had like a little picture of me, like doing a silly face or something. And then my sister was like, your videos, like, I'm so supportive of your channel, but your videos are really boring. Like, damn it. So I kind of stopped. And I don't know if I should have stopped or not stopped. I think they may have gotten better faster. But I ended up just doing a lot of thinking about what do I want to do and what kind of ideas and like what are all these different little channels I want to create. And then now it's just starting slowly, but really it was when I went to that conference, actually it's little pieces. It was January of 2023. Mm-hmm. that I read a white paper within my field and they said, oh, wouldn't it be great if we had a YouTube channel that answered these questions about geospatial intelligence? And I looked it up online and I didn't see anybody doing it. And I was like, oh, I think I can step into that. And yet at the same time realized because it was so professional and government and stuff like that, I was like, I'm also like, I have the skills and the fact that I'm willing to be on camera and mm-hmm. a lot of them don't have a spokesperson.
Yeah.
Like in terms of a personality, they have like very corporatized videos. They're very professionally produced, but they lack a face and a personality. So I was like, okay, cool. I see potential to step into that gap, but also realize that I just had more of a learning curve. And then recently collaborations have just become a thing where I'm sort of saying, hey, come and let's do something. Let's have a conversation. It's just an interview style, or, you know, let's run through a PowerPoint or a course presentation together, or let's see what we want to do. And those are coming together well. Google introduced us to a 1-hour intro to machine learning. Mm-hmm. And when I saw that, I was like, ooh, they said, take the materials and make it your own, go teach it. And I found myself thinking that I wanted to do it in one of our North American hangouts. Someone sort of was like, oh, I'm an ML expert. And I said, hey, do you want to teach that intro to ML class? And she said, yes, let's do it. And I said, on YouTube? And she's like, yep. So she created the PowerPoint, she updated all the code, and we just delivered that one. And I'm so proud of it. But what it's missing now is an intro video to say, hey, I'm so proud of this video, but if you really want to get the value out of this, don't be sitting on your phone and on your couch, like scrolling through this and just watch it. Like, you need to be sitting in front of your computer. You need to do a split screen, and you need to like have the video and then have the code and like run through the code. And I need to like prepare people for like how to get the most value out of this intro to machine learning video. Uh-huh. And then with the podcast, I'm now starting putting a cover and starting to week by week release them a month after they premiere on 360 Talk Radio. And I'm also wanting to write a blog that kind of introduces the guests and the topic and just some highlights and encourage people to go there and listen. So it's begun. I'm probably feel like I'm about a year. It'll take me about a year to monetize a collective of these. Like maybe one will pop sooner, but it's going to be a year long process for me to really learn how to be a good editor, to learn how to just dial it all in. And it's and that's why when people are like, oh, let's rev share this, I'm like, well, when I spent the entire day editing, there's no way I'm sharing a dollar until I hire an editor. Yeah. Because I had to learn how to edit first. But then there are tasks that once I figure them out, that I can sort of bring other people in to do those things. But the key for me is once I know how to do them.
Yeah. Well, video, I've just started dabbling in video editing, and oh man, there's a lot to learn. So I feel you. I would love to hire somebody to do it.
But some of it's also pretty basic. Just, you know, if again, getting out of that I'll fix it in post mindset and try to get your production right so that you're just trimming the end, trimming the beginning, trimming the end, and like trimming any of sort of the, you know, transitions. But I do find like some of my favorite YouTubers have templates. They do that once they get it, they do the same thing over and over again. I think what I don't have yet is a template. I'm just experimenting.
Okay. Yeah.
And also think that the thing I also don't have yet, like I have, what I'm super excited is I have a community of collaborators. Uh-huh. The collaborators are showing up. When I go out in the world, I meet people who are like, tell me about your channel. So I also think as my channel gets better, I'll be more proud to like direct people to it. Mm-hmm. Right now, it's like, if the algorithm doesn't find you, don't worry about it. Like, and that's like one of my favorite things about YouTube is that we're not producing Super Bowl commercials, meaning we're not capturing the attention of millions of people who are going to watch it no matter what and just don't have a choice to be there. And then we'll have an opinion about how did you do with your Super Bowl commercial. What I love about virality is if it's not great, it's okay because not a lot of people are going to see it. Yeah. And you're okay. Like it's, and so even the perfectionist in you has to understand, like, you'll make bad videos before you make good videos.
Right.
And so you have to just, there's a point where, and I think that was like the big takeaway from that conference. When I came out of that conference, I was like, I'm owning my identity as a YouTuber. And that was a big, like, and then I just kind of was like, I don't even have a word. And then I realized my computer was kind of at capacity for editing. And then I realized I was like, wow, like I need to like work on like infrastructure, file organization, understand where are my assets. So when I actually say, okay, I'm ready to do this video, the pictures, the ideas, like all those things that I've gathered, can I even like pull them together to even get them in editing software? And then I realized that the editing software that I use for audio editing has video features, but I didn't really optimize them or use them. I was trying to learn Premiere Pro, which is super sophisticated. I get a great student discount on it. But the problem with Premiere Pro is that when you use an asset, it doesn't pull the asset into the software. Mm-hmm. So one called VSDC, where it pulls the asset into the software. Once you sort of save your working file, if you were to then delete all your assets off of your hard drive or wherever you were storing them, it would not have a problem proceeding. It just, because it they're in the software now. It takes them, it uploads them, and it uses them. The problem with Premiere Pro is all Premiere Pro does is point to the assets. And if you change anything on the back end and you move any of those files, as I learned the hard way, it suddenly gets a media error. And so you have to be really clear about like where things are stored and not move them. Otherwise, your whole video will fall apart.
Yeah, I think those are way more sophisticated than the software. I'm just looking at like CapCut and trying to, and even that is kicking my butt a little bit, but you know, learn. Well,
I've used, and actually that's one thing I did. I don't know if it helps or not helps, but I actually downloaded several different edit on my phone editors and tried them and compared them against each other. So I used CapCut, Splice, PowerDirector, a whole bunch of others. And I ended up with PowerDirector being my favorite among them. But I would suggest trying a couple side by side. And a lot of them give you like a 7-day free trial or 14-day free trial and just see where they work for you, because they all have different pros and cons and different features. Another thing I learned is that Dropbox takes a lot of my files, but they're not stored in the cloud. They're still taking up room on my desktop. And so I was like, oh, well, maybe I can just like buy extra storage and move things to Google Cloud. I kind of tried that, but I put a lot of photos in Google Photo. There are advantages to that and disadvantages to that. But what I realized, a lot of these cell phone editors all can sync, and even Canva can sync to Dropbox. They don't sync to Google Photos. So the now I'm realizing like I can clear up storage by maybe perhaps taking my PDF files and non picture and video files over the Google hard drive where I bought more storage, but leave all my photos and videos on Dropbox so that I can easily sync and access them from both Canva and my cell phone video editor.
Nice.
So yeah, there's all of these little details that you learn. And that's why I think the challenge is like, it's just beginning. Just begin because there's magic in that.
Thing that I feel like corporate pressure actually, you know, it saps your creativity. So that idea where people are just given like more and more and more on their plates and they're like, just, you know, keep up, and where you're constantly just trying to keep up and you have all these things taking up space in your brain, it's very hard to be creative. Like I think that's a big missing link in a lot of these big companies, where if you overload people, you don't give them space, headspace to be creative, it's not happening. They're just gonna keep doing what they've been doing. You're not gonna get any innovative ideas or directions. And you know, I mean, we see it all the time, right? Like it's normally the startups that come up with the good ideas, and the big corporations get bogged down and aren't able to keep it going, right? They just acquire smaller companies that have that creativity in their culture until they become part of the machine.
Yep. I'm excited. I mean, you have such an incredible resume from a corporate point of view, and it's interesting and exciting to see you now step into your own space and sort of how that's going to continue to grow and evolve. And you have so much value to add, because so many people don't know how to succeed within a corporate environment, who want those jobs, and that there's plenty of opportunities there, and that there's also plenty of opportunities to do and start your own thing or contribute to smaller entities where you get a little bit more flexibility, freedom, creativity. You're obviously clearly showing up as a leader, which is super exciting. And you've obviously had led in a corporate environment and now getting to lead in ways where the world needs you. And I am very excited for you. So as we wrap this up, you know, just give us some parting words of advice you have for people, and, you know, just some of your big takeaway things that you'd like to leave people to take away.
Yeah, I mean, I think we already touched on it when you mentioned something about it and I said how much it resonated with me. It was about that idea of don't seek perfection, learn through doing, learn through making mistakes, and just, especially for women, just be comfortable being uncomfortable, because it's always, there's always going to be something that's going to put you out of your comfort zone. Unless, and you know, if you care about growing, which I care about growing deeply, and I think a lot of people do, and I think that's where you really need to make sure that you let go of that need for comfort, right? Because there's really no growth while you're in your comfort zone. It's not happening.